This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump is defending his remarks to Bob Woodward, in which he acknowledges publicly downplaying the coronavirus threat. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Asked at a news conference why he lied to the American people, the president shook his head, saying what he did was minimize the threat to avoid causing panic.
There was no lie here.
And that his actions to stop the virus's spread show he took it seriously.
That doesn't mean I'm going to jump up and down in the air and start saying, people are going to die, people are going to die. No.
Still, Democrats like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi say his public downplaying revealed a president unconcerned with saving American lives.
Showed his contempt. Contempt for the American people and their health.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
And President Trump tried to shift attention onto his Democratic rival Joe Biden at a rally in the U.S. state of Michigan. AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
President Trump tells a suburban Detroit crowd that Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward's book, Questioning His Handling of the Coronavirus Pandemic, raises undue alarm.
This whack job that wrote the book, he said, well, Trump knew a little bit. They wanted me to come out and scream, people are dying.
In Woodward's recorded interviews with Trump, the president admitted to knowing the deadly threat posed by the virus and still opted to publicly ignore that threat. Trump also accused his Democratic rival of spreading rumors.
Joe Biden is once again hurting innocent people with his dangerous anti-vaccine conspiracy theories.
Recently, Biden said even if it cost him the election, he would agree to be vaccinated with a safe and effective vaccine. I'm Tim McGuire.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. health officials have begun two new studies to test if blood thinners can help reduce some of the most dangerous effects of COVID-19. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn with details.
As doctors learn more about COVID-19 and virus deaths, they're more often finding blood clots in patients who died and signs those clots have damaged the heart, kidneys, lungs, blood vessels, and other organs. So the director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, Dr. Gary Gibbons, says they're testing blood thinners to see if they might help prevent strokes, heart attacks, and other complications. Hospitals have been giving anti-clotting drugs to the most seriously ill patients, still trying to learn which drugs or doses will work the best and at what stage of illness. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Meanwhile, the Northern California wildfire has become the state's deadliest of the year, with at least 10 people confirmed dead, and the toll could climb because many people are missing. The one sheriff's investigator found that 7 bodies on Thursday, this is the day after 3 other victims were discovered. Among those unaccounted for are grandparents who told their son that they were going to escape the flames by finding shelter in a pond. The 3 weeks old fire was about 50% contained when winds drove it into explosive territory on Tuesday. Some 2,000 homes and other buildings officially have burned, according to many officials. The coronavirus pandemic is changing commemorations of the September 11th terror attacks because of a split over how to hold observances in time of social distancing. There will be dueling ceremonies Friday at the 9/11 Memorial Plaza in a corner nearby in New York. U.S. President Donald Trump is speaking at a ceremony at the Flight 93 National Memorial in Pennsylvania, where Democratic challenger Joe Biden intends to pay respects later in that day. Biden also plans to attend the observance at Ground Zero, while Vice President Mike Pence is due there and at the alternate observance nearby. The Indian and Chinese foreign ministers agreed their troops should disengage from a tense border standoff, maintain proper distance, and ease tensions in the cold desert Ladakh region, where the two sides had their deadliest clash in decades in June. They met in the Russian capital Thursday night and concurred that the current situation in the border areas is not in the interest of either side. That's according to a joint statement issued by both on Friday. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Africa sees progress in coronavirus fight, but also setbacks.
This network will help us to track the evolution of the virus, to better develop vaccines and treatments tailored to African populations, and it will also help us to stay a step ahead of COVID-19.
Guinea's Constitutional Court approves President Condé's bid for a third term. We'll get reaction. There are reported breakthroughs in Morocco-Libya talks. South Africa's illegal gold miners risk lives for livelihoods. And record flooding in Sudan kills 100.
At least 103 people have been killed by drowning, houses collapsing, and road accidents caused by the flooding. Now, thousands of Sudanese families are sleeping in the outdoors, waiting for shelter, food, and medicine.
And Africa's Cashew Alliance meets to discuss falling prices amid COVID-19. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African continent is seeing both advances and setbacks in its fight against the coronavirus. This week, officials welcomed the opening of a network of genome sequencing laboratories. At the same time, the continent's first vaccine trial has been put on hold after one participant in the Oxford-based trial became ill. Viewer's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
First, the good news from Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa. On Thursday, she announced that the WHO and the African Centers for Disease Control are opening 12 laboratories on the continent to work on COVID-19 genome sequencing and data analysis. She explained.
This network will help us to track the evolution of the virus, to better develop vaccines and treatments tailored to African populations, and it will also help us to stay a step ahead of COVID-19.
And now, with that forward step, here's the step back. The continent's first vaccine trial, being held in South Africa, has been paused. British-Swedish pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca announced this week it had to halt large-scale global trials of its COVID-19 vaccine because a volunteer participant in Britain became ill after receiving the experimental drug. In South Africa, the University of the Witwatersrand is testing the same vaccine on about 2,000 volunteers. The director of the South Africa trial, Professor Shabir Madi, announced the decision late Wednesday.
Pausing vaccination to review safety is evidence of the application of sound clinical practice and demonstrates the rigor of the independent oversight process under which the trials has been conducted. Assessing the safety of the vaccine is the reason why studies such as these are essential in South Africa before there is widespread use of the vaccine.
Moeti added that the study's decision to pause actually demonstrates the scientific strategy against the virus is working as it should.
One of the purposes of a clinical trial is to identify exactly this possibility that there may be adverse effects, as they are called, in the use of a tool. And in this case, very correctly, when it was found that a volunteer who had been healthy developed an illness, the study has been halted for the moment and all paused. And I think what this should be regarded as something that you might expect in the course of a clinical trial. So it should not cause us to panic.
Moeti added that globally there are 8 other candidate vaccines in phase 3 of trials. The sub-Saharan Africa region so far has reported just over 1 million confirmed COVID-19 cases, lower than in many parts of the world. The United States currently carries the world's heaviest burden of the virus, with more than 6.2 million cases, according to WHO data. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Sudanese authorities have declared a 3-month state of emergency after record flooding left over 100 people dead and tens of thousands homeless. Floodwaters are also threatening to damage Sudan's ancient Mero pyramids, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
The River Nile has crested to its highest level in 100 years. At least 103 people have been killed by drowning, houses collapsing, and road accidents caused by the flooding. Now, thousands of Sudanese families are sleeping in the outdoors, waiting for shelter, food, and medicine. 40-year-old widow Aisha Adam is one of them. Adam says she is sleeping in the street after the river suddenly destroyed her house in northern Khartoum. She says she is looking after her sister and 5 children and waiting for shelter and aid. The Sudanese government has made an urgent call for organizations and civil society to provide assistance. UN agencies started efforts this week to supply medicine, tents, and safe drinking water. This is Tina Gucci-Koto, deputy head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan.
Help is definitely required.
He says help is definitely required from the government and their partners in the UN and NGOs. Besides civil society, the urgent needs are for plastic sheets, tents, health supplies, and the provision of safe drinking water. Floodwaters are also threatening to damage Sudan's ancient Meru pyramids, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The National Museum of Sudan was also affected by the water this week after the flooding hit central Khartoum. UNESCO began to evacuate artifacts from the museum Thursday and said it shall preserve all the affected World Heritage Sites. Siddiq says UNESCO has registered many monumental sites in Sudan. The goal of registration was to preserve this heritage and save it from destruction, whether by human or natural factors. Siddiq adds that the flooding is arousing increasing concerns regarding the sites, especially the museum, so UNESCO started to evacuate it in a coordination with the authorities. Many Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, UAE, and neighboring Egypt, have sent tons of medicine and food supplies this week. The Sudanese government has allocated $2.7 million to help those made homeless. The government is also making plans to combat expected epidemics like malaria and cholera. Meanwhile, the floods are likely to continue, as Sudan's Meteorological Authority expects the rainy season to extend until the end of September. Neba Muhiddin for VUA News, Khartoum.
Rival Libyan political leaders were holding joint talks Thursday in Morocco amid reports of some breakthroughs over key issues, including elections and uniting rival governments. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
أفادت مصادر الحدث باختتام المفاوضات الليبية في المغرب وتوصل إلى تفاهمات غير مسبوقة.
Arab media are reporting breakthroughs on several key points during talks between rival Libyan political leaders outside the Moroccan capital Rabat. It was not clear if any of the breakthroughs would last into further negotiations in Geneva next week. Khaled al-Mishri, the Islamist head of the Council of State in Tripoli, told Al Jazeera TV Wednesday, "We cannot say that the Morocco meetings are real dialogue sessions so far. Rather, they are preliminary consultations for the start of the dialogue." Libya analyst and political writer Abdel Basset Ben Hamel says that the Moroccan talks are not expected to follow the same track as the upcoming Geneva talks, and in any case, there is absolutely no talk about disbanding militias and making mercenaries leave the country. Libya is currently divided between Eastern and Western governments locked in a military stalemate. Arab League Deputy Head Hossam Zaki stressed in a press conference in Cairo that Libya negotiations will not be easy. He says that in all honesty, the Libya dossier is going to require the goodwill of all sincere parties who want to get the country out of this impasse. Arab League head Ahmed Abu Ghait condemned Turkey for interfering in the internal affairs of Arab countries after a meeting in Cairo to discuss the Libya situation. He says the Arab states widely oppose Turkish interference. He argues that Arab states must combat this kind of interference so that they don't become a battleground for internecine conflicts. Turkey backs the UN-recognized Government of National Accord based in Tripoli and has provided military support for its forces. While it was not clear if any of the discussions in Morocco included binding agreements, members of both delegations told Arab media that one of the key points of agreement was to divide positions in the ruling Council of State from among Libya's three geographic regions. Libyan media also reported that negotiators in Switzerland, where talks are due to get underway on September 17th, have agreed that elections must be held by December 2021 based on a mutually acceptable constitutional framework. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 11th.
Guinean President Alpha Conde can seek a third term, according to the country's constitutional court. Opposition and civil society groups say the president is violating the tenets of democracy after amending the constitution to enable him to seek an additional term in office. The constitutional court also approved 11 candidates to contest in the upcoming October election. Sidya Touré, the leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the constitutional court ruling is an affront to the country's democracy.
He just put some people of his party as member of the constitutional court. So I'm not surprised by this decision.
What can the opposition do about this?
Just nothing. We decide, but we continue to demonstrate because we have no other solution. So we continue to demonstrate. This is what we can do.
Is there any unity among the opposition about this ruling, going on demonstration and protesting it?
So we have one of opposition party, was UFDJ, who decided to go to presidential election versus the St. Louis party. But, you know, they know absolutely we cannot win. I think we want to go there and to show the people that what will be not a fair and free election. This is their position. We say that we know that because we know what is the electoral list. We have 2.5 million people who was in this electoral list, and we didn't have assurance that they put it out. You know, this is why Organisation Francophonie they left. So we know, but it's absolutely not a good electoral list. We are not going. We continue to protest, but St. Louis, I'm going to show that it was something wrong.
Well, as a friend and an ally of Celine Diallo, a former prime minister just like yourself, are you disappointed that his party decided to participate in the upcoming election? And will you also decide to change your mind to participate in the election?
My party is not going to participate, that's absolutely sure, because we have no opportunity to. So that we'll have fair and free election. We see that during the past election, you know, Alpha has everything, he has all records in his hands. So the decision of Selu, so I'm a little disappointed, but anyway, I know that he cannot succeed.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has called on West African leaders to stick to their constitutional term limit, which he described as a source of crisis and political tension in the region. Your case, some people say, is different because there was an amendment to the constitution that allows President Conde to seek an additional term. What is your reaction?
That's just absolutely nonsense. Alpha Conde start to put a new constitution on place, but take more than 1 year. So he killed people for that, you know. There was nothing in the former constitution we continue to defend. We can able to him to be candidate. From that, he decided to have a new constitution just for him to be candidate. I don't think that, no, that's not true.
Sidya Touré is the leader of Guinea's opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Conakry. Illegal mining in South Africa is among the most lucrative on the continent, pushing miners to risk health and safety in mostly abandoned shafts. But the chance to strike it rich drives the miners, who are often armed, to defend their illegal claims. Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
Poverty and desperation are pushing some South Africans, like Joseph, who only gave his first name, to risk their lives mining illegally in the hope of finding gold. Joseph is not mining underground for fear of being trapped or killed in the shafts, although conditions on the surface are just as dangerous. He says they are working under dangerous environments where there's no safety and their health is at risk because they inhale dust and chemicals while digging and processing. It's very tough, says Joseph, who has a family at home to look after. This is my only source of survival, he says. They work from morning to sunset, says Joseph, and for them to produce a gram of gold, it sometimes takes a day or two. Known as Zama Zamas, Zulu for to try, some of them once worked in a lawful mining industry. James Wellsted is with South Africa's second largest gold producer, Sibanye-Stillwater.
You know, the mining sector over many years has shrunk quite a lot in South Africa as well, which has meant that a lot of ex-miners are now don't have jobs, and therefore some of them resort to illegal mining. And it is a very big challenge for the mining industry and the country as a whole.
The illegal miners hire their own security guards to alert them to police raids and defend against rival miners. Security guard Selemba, who also gave only a first name, says, just like the miners, he has few options for taking care of his family. He says each time anyone goes down the shaft, that individual has to pay something. And when the miner gets out, says Selemba, he also gives us some of the material. We are working shifts, he says. Each team works for 2 nights a week. But the Zama Zamas do not only risk their own safety, says Wellsted.
They're armed often, so there's a threat to our employees if they run into these illegal miners underground and the risk that it poses to them. Obviously, corruption of employees and fraud that goes on associated with this illegal mining. And then, obviously, you know, they are stealing resources that belong to us, or we have the right to mine.
To end the problems of unlawful mining, Wellsted says authorities need to create more job options for the miners. Meanwhile, despite days of finding nothing, the miners keep digging. Living up to their name for the Zama Zamas, there is no other choice but to try. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The African Cashew Alliance is holding its annual conference this week virtually to inform cashew producers about falling prices and how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting exports. Blessing Okam, a spokesperson for the African Cashew Alliance, tells Ricky Stryer that West African cashew producers will benefit from the information provided at the conference.
Well, we had stakeholders from the different producing countries coming to share with us what is happening. They realize that there is coronavirus, but that is not slowing down the market. It's still in Africa. That is not slowing down production. It's not slowing down processing in Africa. So with such resolve on just a forum, why would you want to pause or withhold the conference? So we said to ourselves, people love doing. People are connected every 2 weeks to join us. Let's to give them the tool. Our goal is to be that place that people come to and they get the information they want.
Can you give me an example of one of the speakers or one of the specific talks that's going to happen at the conference that addresses a unique need that has arisen during the COVID crisis in the cashew industry?
Definitely, I can actually give you two. So two topics that are very, very critical for this year's conference, actually under the theme, building a viable cashew value chain to withstand market disruptions. One is on policies and its impact on cashew trade, where we have a speaker from the Consultative International Cashew Council coming to speak on behalf of the public sector. So this DICC is an organization that has been established, okay, brings all stakeholders, but at a ministerial level, together to discuss issues that can trickle down to the various countries at the national level. So one of the topics that we are looking at is policies and their impact on cashew trade. What policies do we have now? Can they make our markets able to withstand disruptions? And then the other topic that we are also working seriously to bring up become next week, which is the week of our conference. It has to do with cashew processing technology and its incubation. And for this particular panel, we are looking at telling people that there's market disruptions. Corona is one. Do you know that affects the industry? So why don't you do processing at origin? Okay, the borders are closed. People are not moving. So So why don't you be processing at origin? So that's something that we are looking at. So one thing we are looking at is policies and their impact on cashew trees, and then cashew processing technology and its incubation.
What are some of the challenges that you guys have found that some people face in these countries when they are trying to increase processing at origin?
Okay, so one of the things that I can tell you is access to finance. Okay, access to finance, processing at origin, how many people can actually set up a processing unit and run it efficiently with the up-to-date mechanization? It's access to finance. Access to finance at the right time, because by the time a bank is approving a loan, the season might have been over and probably you didn't buy anything. So access to finance is something that can help processing at origin, because then factories will be established. People will have money to set up factories, up equipment to run them.
That was Blessing Okam, a spokesperson for the African Cashew Alliance. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Accra. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the decision of the Confederation of African Football to push back the semi-finals and final of its Champions League by another 3 weeks because of a spike in coronavirus cases and new travel restrictions in Morocco, which has two teams in the last four. The Confederation of African Football made the decision at a video conference meeting of its executive committee and after a request by the Moroccan Soccer Association. The first legs of the semi-finals of Africa's biggest club competition will now be played on October 17th and 18th, the second legs on October 23rd and 24th, and the final will be on November the 6th. CAF also delayed the semi-finals and final of its other main club competition, the CAF Confederations Cup. All those Confederations Cup games are due to be played in Morocco, which agreed to host the remainder of that tournament in a Final Four format. And now to the missing African Cup trophy in Egypt, where Egypt's Ministry of Youth and Sports has confirmed that the country's prosecutor general has been requested to investigate the case of the trophies that went missing from the storehouse of the Egyptian Football Association. The EFA announced on Friday last week that some of the old trophies at the association's storehouse had gone missing, including the African Cup of Nations, which was retained for life by Egypt after winning three consecutive African titles in 2006, 2008, and 2010. The case took a new direction on Wednesday when the Egyptian public prosecution revealed that the case is now in the hands of the public funds prosecution. Staying with football news, the Senegalese Football Federation have confirmed two friendlies against Morocco and neighboring Mauritania next month. The Taranga Lions will travel to face Morocco's Atlas Lions in Rabat on October the 9th before hosting Mauritania 4 days later in Thiens. The two matches will serve as a build-up to November's total African Cup of Nations Cameroon 2021 qualifier against the Jutors of Guinea-Bissau. And now to athletics, where marathon world record holder Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge has promised an interesting but beautiful race when he defends his London Marathon title on October the 4th in the British capital city. Kipchoge, who is the reigning Olympic marathon champion, noted that he had experienced tough and difficult times where he has not been able to train in a large group owing to COVID-19 restrictions, but he says he's overcoming all of that now and looking forward to the October 4th London Marathon. Olympic champion Caster Semenya is defiant in the wake of a decision by the Swiss Federal Tribunal to uphold the 2019 ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sports that ordered her to take medication to reduce her testosterone levels in order to compete. Caster Semenya's appeal to Switzerland's Federal Supreme Court was dismissed on Tuesday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Border Crossings.
Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.